Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The buzz in Washington is humming today around the federal courthouse where Scooter Libby, the former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, is being arraigned. He was indicted last Friday, part of the investigation into who leaked information to reporters in 2003 about CIA officer Valerie Plame. Libby has been charged with five counts of obstructing justice, perjury, and making false statements. If special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald is correct, Libby wove an intricate tale of lies about his role in outing Plame. The spotlight has now shifted somewhat to his former boss, Vice President Dick Cheney. Political columnists, media pundits, and journalists alike are asking what the vice president did or didn't know about the CIA leak. A cloud also hangs over Karl Rove, political strategist for President Bush. A story in the Washington Post today says he may be charged with making false statements during the CIA probe. Today on Point, tough questions for the White House in the CIA leak investigation. You can join the conversation. Do you think Scooter Libby is getting what he deserves? Is the vice president getting off too lightly? Where does fault lie in this mess? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First to Washington now for the latest in the investigation into the CIA leak. Joining us, John Harwood, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal. Hello, John.
Good morning.
First of all, tell us the news this morning, the situation at the federal courthouse, and the apparent growing grumbling inside the White House by White House staffers about Bush advisor Karl Rove.
Well, Scooter Libby's being arraigned today on the charges Patrick Fitzgerald is bringing, which include perjury, making false statements, and obstruction of justice. He's augmented his legal team. He's got a couple of high-profile white-collar criminal defense lawyers who have been successful in public corruption cases in the past. And one of the questions hanging over this trial is, do those men end up negotiating some sort of a plea deal, or do they, as signaled by Libby and his lawyers from the start last week when he was charged, is he going to fight these charges and try to be vindicated? If he does the latter, that's more problematic for Republicans. Now, the other question about Karl Rove, the signals that Patrick Fitzgerald sent last week were that he did not expect to charge any other person, even though the inquiry was not closed. There is no grand jury. He'd have to call another grand jury in. So long as he doesn't close out the inquiry, there is a cloud over Karl Rove. But I think the odds are that Rove will not be charged and he's not going anywhere.
Washington Post reports that he does remain a legal target of the special prosecutor Fitzgerald in connection with a case, further reporting that sources close to Rove say they expect to know within a couple of weeks whether or not Rove will, in fact, be accused of a crime. There's, as you point out, no way for us to know that now, whether he will be or he won't be. If he does face charges, is it safe to assume he'll suffer Lewis Libby's fate and he'll have to resign? But if he's not charged, is he still too hot for the Bush White House? Will he go? Does he need to go for President Bush's sake?
I think if he is charged with a crime, there's no doubt that he will meet the same fate as Scooter Libby and leave the White House. It would be pretty much impossible for him to function if he were had been indicted. If he doesn't, you know, I think the question is how much of a public issue and how much of a drumbeat is created around his presence there. We did see a suggestion from Trent Lott, the former Republican leader in the Senate this week, that maybe Karl Rove couldn't continue to work effectively. If you start getting cracks on the Republican side joining in with the demands from Democrats, then it might get too hot for Karl Rove to stay there. If Republicans alternatively close ranks around the White House and decide that it's time for them to stop fighting with the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, then I think the situation might cool down and Karl Rove would be able to stay.
Of course, the only person who's thinking really matters is President Bush. What do you
exactly
think?
What
do you think the president is considering for Rove?
Well, I think the president knows that Karl Rove has been with him every step of the way of his political career, and I think he probably has a hard time imagining functioning without Karl. Karl Rove is the guy who has knitted together the politics and the policy of this White House, trying to figure out when to compromise, when to fight, what constituencies you get to try to make 50% plus one in an election and hold a majority beyond the current era. So Karl Rove is the closest thing there is to an indispensable player in the White House, but as we've seen in the past, even people considered indispensable at some point sometimes leave and life goes on.
John Harwood, we know you have to go. Thank you very much, John Harwood, political editor for The Wall Street Journal.
My pleasure.
Joining us now, John Nichols, political writer for The Nation. Hello, John.
Hello. It's good to be with you.
Let's reset this, if you don't mind. Take us through the charges that led to Louis Libby's indictment. In your the way you look at it, do they add up? Do they make sense?
Well, sure, they make sense. I don't think anybody, left or right, Democrat or Republican, could read the documentation on the indictment and not see that there's some pretty serious charges here and a pretty serious pattern of behavior that fits. We begin by beginning with the war, what I think someone recently referred to as the original sin of the Bush administration. The war in Iraq was something that Vice President Cheney and Scooter Libby and Libby's former professor from Yale, Paul Wolfowitz, desperately wanted the United States to get into. They wanted this war to be fought. And they aggressively promoted it. Far beyond anything President Bush said, this trio argued that there were weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was reconstituting a nuclear capacity, things of that nature. All that is the sort of base from which we begin. The war started, it happened, and about 3 or 4 months afterwards, Joe Wilson, a former ambassador and really someone who was one of the heroes of the first Gulf War, a close ally and comrade, if you will, of former President Bush, the father, wrote an article for the New York Times. And before that, he had actually leaked a little bit to a New York Times columnist, but then he wrote an article for the New York Times in which he said that the arguments for going to war had not been valid, and that, in fact, the members of the Bush administration had known that. And he pointed a pretty strong finger at Vice President Cheney's office. Around the time of the initial column that appeared, and then by a New York Times columnist, and then also the piece that Wilson wrote, it appears that Scooter Libby, the vice president's very close aide, someone who's more like a brother than an employee of the vice president, met with the vice president to talk about what to do about this problem they had. And shortly thereafter, it appears that Scooter Libby made a number of phone calls to prominent journalists in Washington to try and destroy Joe Wilson's reputation by suggesting that the only reason he was sent to Africa was because his wife was an employee of the CIA. That's the basic underpinning of this. It appears to have been an effort to both defend the case made by Vice President Cheney and his aides for going to war, and also to punish those who might challenge that information, particularly from the intelligence elite of the country. Shortly after that occurred, there was an outcry because, of course, we had a situation where it appears a covert operative, Joe Wilson's wife, was outed, and from there came the investigation led by Patrick Fitzgerald, a Republican prosecutor from Illinois. And Fitzgerald spent a very long period of time on this investigation. A lot of the media coverage of it was incredibly misguided. It focused on Karl Rove because Rove is a bigger-than-life figure, and it's sort of fun to talk about the guy they call Bush's brain. But Fitzgerald actually focused in on where the real action was and where the real issues were, and that was in Dick Cheney's office. And I think we are not at the end of this process. We are very much in the midst of it. We don't know whether there'll be a trial. We don't know what'll come with that. We also don't know whether the investigation will continue further. John Harwood mentioned that he didn't think there would be further indictments, but I don't read Fitzgerald's statements that way. I think Fitzgerald might well go further in this investigation. The problem is that so many people in Washington are obsessed with Karl Rove. That's all they ask about.
Well,
there are many other people to look at.
Let's stay on Louis Libby for just a minute here and bring another voice to the conversation. John Fund, columnist for The Wall Street Journal's opinionjournal.com. Good morning, John.
Pleasure.
Let me ask you for your take on the Libby indictment and the inner workings of the White House that apparently led to this point today where Libby walks into court.
Well, first of all, the perjury charges against Mr. Libby are obviously very serious. He has a lot to answer for in court. Secondly, look, I have been critical of this administration, both its handling of 9/11 intelligence matters and its handling on the intelligence matters leading up to the Iraq War. And they clearly made mistakes in the handling of this case. But I agree with John Nichols. I have never seen more misguided media coverage. And I have to tell you, you know, I have, if you want to go back to my political diary online of Wednesday last week, I predicted exactly what the charges would be. I predicted that it would only stop with Mr. Libby. It would not extend to Mr. Rove or others. And my sources, the Justice Department, who have so far been excellent, assure me that regardless of what people speculate or want to believe, there are not going to be any more indictments, and we are going to learn that within 10 days. Having said that, this has been a tremendous political embarrassment for the administration. But one thing that I think we have to remember here, if you read the Senate Intelligence Committee report carefully, which is a bipartisan, unanimous report about Mr. Wilson, regardless of whether or not he was a hero in the first Gulf War, his behavior in this present imbroglio is not something that I think we should take to the bank. If you read the Senate Intelligence Committee report, which is a bipartisan report, it is clear that Mr. Wilson has not been accurate, he has prevaricated, and he has withheld significant information. That doesn't take away from the perjury charges against Mr. Libby, but I think we should take some of what he says with a grain of salt. In addition, you know, remember, what Scooter Libby did was he called reporters and gave them relevant information on Mr. Wilson. It may have been sneaky, but it's something that's common in Washington. Whether it was ethical is a separate matter. But one of the things that we have to understand is, did what Mr. Libby say, was it true about Ambassador Wilson? And from the information that we have and from the sources that I have, regardless of whether or not it was proper for him to do that, what he said about Mr. Wilson and the fact that Mr. Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, did indeed play a role in sending him to Niger happened to be true.
John Fund, we need to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the investigation into the CIA leak. Scooter Libby is being arraigned today, and tough questions are now being asked of Vice President Dick Cheney. You can join the conversation. How far up the flagpole should the investigation go? Do you think that protecting the identity of CIA officers is such a sacred part of our democracy that heads should roll when one is outed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Joining us this morning, John Nichols, political writer for The Nation and author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. Also joining us, John Fund, columnist for The Wall Street Journal's OpinionJournal.com. And joining us now, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Bob.
Jack, your take on the arraignment and the links between Libby and Cheney. Cheney, whom we've only talked about so far this morning in just a headline.
Well, yeah, that's the question. I mean, is Mr. Libby a principal or an agent? Was he acting for Cheney or just acting on his own? And what strikes me is that the charges against him in a legal context apply to Mr. Cheney in a political context. One of the charges, of course, is obstruction of justice for Mr. Libby because he didn't tell the truth to the grand jury. But now we learn that Mr. Cheney has helped to obstruct an investigation, the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation. According to the National Journal last week, he refused to give, quote, crucial documents to that committee, and the documents related to Louis Libby's speech, the speech that he wrote for Colin Powell, which just on the eve of the war Powell delivered, which seemed to close the case for the war, and which passages Powell threw out using an expletive because he said they were so completely distorted. Cheney refused to supply those to the committee, we now find out. Then the second charge against Mr. Libby, again, in a political context, that is to say, in the context of plain talk in a democracy, applies to Mr. Cheney in making false statements. You know, practically everything he has said about the Iraq War in one way or another has been false or inaccurate. For example, you know, going back to December 2001, he talked about a connection between Mohammed Atta, the leading terrorist of September 11th, and Saddam, even as contemporaneous FBI and Czech intelligence reports were making clear that wasn't so. And he was asked about that later by a reporter, and three times he denied saying what he had said. Go back to the fall of 2002 on Meet the Press. Saddam, he said, has reconstituted his nuclear weapons. We now know he did not have the intelligence that said that. That was a claim way in advance of the facts. Was it a false, deliberate lie? Did he really believe it? The effect is the same. He distorted public information. He made false statements again and again and again about this most important public policy initiative of the Bush administration.
But were there, I want to bring John Fund back into the conversation here, were these intentional, or were they simply mistakes, misinterpretation of intelligence? It seems that there are, among the many questions, two key questions still out there. Was there proven systematic manipulation of pre-war intelligence? Was there proven a systematic effort to quash criticism from those who suspected the accuracy of the pre-war intelligence? John Fund.
Well, I think your listeners would be well served to remember that there are two elements of malpractice here. One is certainly the intelligence failures that led to, in part, to the Iraq conflict. There's another malpractice, which I agree with John Nichols, the misguided media coverage, which is, I think, preventing us from getting a full picture of what this story is all about. Jack Beatty says that what the vice president did with the Senate Intelligence Committee amounts to a political obstruction of justice. Well, I've talked with Murray Wass, who's the author of much of that material that has done broken stories in the National Journal, Mr. Beatty's employer, and he says, look, what some people view as an obstruction of justice, other people would say is executive privilege. You don't share with the legislative branch things that the executive branch thinks should be kept to itself. And as for the whole covert agent issue, let me be clear. Mr. Fitzgerald was asked four times, he's the prosecutor, he was asked four times during his press conference last week, was Valerie Plame a covert agent? He refused to answer. My Justice Department sources tell me there is a reason why he refused to answer, and there's a reason why he didn't charge Mr. Libby with outing her. Under the law, the 1982 law that was being the center of this investigation, she was not covered. Now, we can talk about all the mistakes the administration has been made, but if we're going to talk about malpractice and intelligence matters, let's also talk about the media malpractice that I agree with John Nichols has taken us in some different directions because we don't have the basic facts before us.
Jack Beatty.
Well, I don't know about the media manipulation. I mean, I agree about this media manipulation. You know, Patrick Fitzgerald said we would have been here a year ago with these indictments, but for Judith Miller's contestation of his subpoena. In effect, you know, what was happening a year ago? We were a week before a presidential election. That indictment didn't come down because Judith Miller withheld information and made a federal case literally out of it when there was no case law, when there was no protection of, you know, shield statute for reporters under federal law, and she carried it all the way to the Supreme Court. Well, you know, you have to wonder. Wait a minute. Now, what were her motives? Was she involved in this? Was this part of her effort with Libby to postpone this whole matter to get it over the presidential election? Now, you can say, well, that's a conspiracy theory. Well, my gosh, Watergate was a conspiracy. Iran-Contra was a conspiracy. More and more, it appears that the Iraq War was a conspiracy. So, there was media manipulation, and indeed.
On the day that Louis Libby appears in court, let's hear what On Point listeners have to think about all this. Listeners, where does the real fault lie? Is this investigation just a witch hunt? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill is calling from Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to ask and make a brief comment, but ask if your guests think that Bush is going, if this is going to get worse for the president, or if we've already seen the worst of it, because it seems like there's been scandal after scandal, and this president has been able to just get through it without making any changes to his staff or, you know, addressing the issues by just ignoring, you know, or just moving on to the next topic. And like with the Abu Ghraib scandal. You know, Rumsfeld, everyone's asking for Rumsfeld to be let go, and the guy's still in power, and now no one's talking about it anymore.
John Nichols, you want to take this?
Sure. I think it will get worse for the president. I think that as I said in my earlier comments, I think we are only at the beginning of this process, not at the end of it. I believe, and I've spent a lot of time covering these people, so I don't claim to speak with absolute authority, but with some certainty, that Scooter Libby is more loyal to Dick Cheney than he is to his country. And so I don't think there's any question that Scooter Libby will do everything in his power to fight these charges. He will not agree to any sort of deal that would harm the vice president. And so I think we'll have a trial. I think it could be a very serious trial and a very explosive one. I would also point out that, you know, we had some criticism of Joe Wilson during this show. And the one thing is, if you put Joe Wilson in front of a camera or in front of a jury, I think he's an incredibly powerful force. And my suspicion is that as more attention focuses on this whole controversy, we will see a lot of damage done to the Bush presidency. I would give one final note, too. I think that what has happened in the last week or so is that the Democratic Party, which has really been a shadow of a functional political party for the last 3 or 4 years, certainly not an opposition party, has begun to feel its oats, for lack of another phrase. The challenge that Harry Reid posed in the Senate on the intelligence issues on Tuesday was very, very significant. And I think you're going to see some things happen in the House in the next few days, which will be directly related to Cheney. Now, admittedly,
what do you mean by that?
I think you will see some members of the House circulate a letter with bipartisan signership or signing onto it that will ask Mr. Cheney to come to the Congress and testify about the issues raised by the indictments in the same way that Gerald Ford, Dick Cheney's former boss, came to testify before Congress about the Nixon pardon and questions about whether there was any conspiracy there. What I'm saying is I think that you're going to see increasing pressure on Dick Cheney, and that pressure really does weaken the Bush presidency because Dick Cheney is so absolutely central, especially to the foreign policy of the Bush administration.
John Fund, do you sense that President Bush's confidence in Dick Cheney is at all shaken?
No, and I have to tell you, I think one of the problems that this scandal has in terms of penetrating to the rest of the country beyond the Beltway and certain segments of the East Coast is the overheated nature of some of this. John Nichols mentioned the overheated nature of the coverage of Karl Rove, which I think drove everyone to suspect that, of course, he was going to be indicted, but he wasn't. Secondly, I have to tell you, you know, I'm just astonished to hear someone say that a person who has been in the highest levels of the federal government in many positions of responsibility, despite the fact that he's been charged now in court, is more loyal to his employer than he is to his country. I find that just an astonishing statement, and I find that just an example of the kind of overheated rhetoric which makes it difficult for people to take this scandal seriously in all of its overheated manifestations. This is a serious problem for the administration, but overplaying it doesn't help your listeners understand it.
Well, though we have been hearing criticism, or at least we've been reading news reports from people inside the White House who have been complaining about Dick Cheney, and I'm wondering if Cheney's influence might be diminished within the rest of the administration beyond the president. Any signs that it might be?
Well, Mr. Cheney was right in the middle of the selection process, which resulted in the nomination of Judge Sam Alito. So if his influence has been diminished, it's not apparent last Friday when that decision was made.
Jack Beatty.
Yeah, his influence, that's really the question, isn't it? How far does it go? Now we have the testimony of Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, That really raises the question of whether there's been, he uses the word cabal, that the Iraq War was in part the work of a cabal out of the vice president's office that was almost, in some cases, working around the president. And Wilkerson said sometimes the president seemed to be calling the shots and sometimes the vice president. And this morning on our morning edition, Wilkerson also went back to this question about the torture issue. Now, we know the vice president wants the United States to be able to torture. He made that clear when he called in John McCain after the Senate by 90 votes said we want the United States not to do this at all. Cheney said, we've got to do this. CIA needs to be able to do this. Well, it turns out that Bush, the way Wilkerson set it up, was Bush puts out a memo, puts out a statement, we're not going to do any torture, that's not U.S. policy. Meanwhile, he says the cabal, Cheney and the people in the and Rumsfeld, his people in the Defense Department, work around that, and they send the message down to the troops. Yeah, that's all right, and they begin to itemize the various things you can do, and that's an example, Wilkerson said, of the way in which Cheney not only is an influence in the administration, but that in a sense he's sort of running it.
John Nichols, I'm wondering if you think the White House might be in danger, or people in the White House, individuals might be in danger of suffering death or serious infection from a thousand cuts, stories about dissatisfaction from people who used to work in the administration or perhaps who still do work in the administration, who've been left with a sour taste in the mouth by or perhaps burned by Louis Libby in the past, perhaps criticized by Vice President Cheney, and who are now seeing the opportunity for a little revenge.
There's simply no question that that is true. And when the history of the Bush administration is written, it will be a history of palace intrigues that were not covered by the media, by and large, because really, in the aftermath of September 11th, we had an almost completely stenographic White House press corps. They took down what the president said and reported it in detail, but they didn't really dig into the White House as aggressively as they should have. There's a reason for that. This White House is more closed, more restrictive, and more punishing of media that challenges it than any White House really since, certainly since Lyndon Johnson's, probably longer than that. And so there's a lot that's going on there that most Americans don't even begin to be aware of. The critical thing to understand as regards the conversation we're having is that almost from the start, Colin Powell and Dick Cheney were the leaders of opposite camps within the White House. They did not speak to one another for the last year of Powell's presence there, but long before that, they clashed on a repeated basis. Powell's staff, which he trusted, told him that Iraq was not a threat. Cheney, who tried desperately to get the CIA to tell him Iraq was a threat, and then finally, with Rumsfeld, had to set up a little operation over in the Defense Department to make the claims, kept pushing back on this. Finally, Powell did make the speech, more out of loyalty to Bush than to anything else, to the UN. But as Powell himself has said in recent weeks, that was the most embarrassing speech of his life. Well, what we know is that that speech, of course, was produced by Scooter Libby, and that even up until minutes before Powell gave it, people from the vice president's office were calling Powell and Powell's aides on their phones, demanding that things be inserted. And finally, one of Powell's aides clicked off his cell phone so he wouldn't get any more calls from the vice president's office. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration. It wasn't just Paul O'Neill who wrote a very good book on all this. There are going to be more books. There's going to be more testimony. And much of it will come back to the reality that Dick Cheney dominated the foreign policy of this administration. And actually, in the end, you know, George Bush will be weakened by this, but he may, for many of his critics, come out looking a little better. Because the reality is, as John Fund points out, and as other folks have pointed out, George Bush wasn't always on the same page as Cheney, and I think will be portrayed by history as someone who was a victim of his vice president rather than a colleague or a co-conspirator.
But I think the larger question on the other side remains, that there's still so much to prove before one can say that there was actual wrongdoing. And are critics of the administration at this point engaged in, you know, we're in New England here, are they engaged in a party boat-sized fishing expedition? John Fund.
Look, I'm in favor of investigations. That's why I supported having a special prosecutor. And we all know that lots of people have bad taste in their mouths from special prosecutors from the 1990s. This administration gave full cooperation to the special prosecutor. It did not attack his motives. It did not attack his credibility or integrity, as some people did with Ken Starr. And I will tell you what career people in the Justice Department, the same career people that surround Patrick Fitzgerald, tell me. No conspiracy was found in the White House. No evidence that Valerie Plame was a covert agent covered by the 1982 law that was at the center of this investigation. No indictment of Karl Rove, and there will be no indictment of Karl Rove. Now, is this a problem for the administration? Yes. But I do not think that this, and I agree here with Lanny Davis, who was in Bill Clinton's White House counsel's office, I do not think it serves the country to have an overheated conspiracy theory attached to what are admittedly serious charges but limited to one individual.
John Fund, John Nichols, Jack Beatty, stay with us. We're discussing the investigation into the CIA leak and today's arraignment of Scooter Libby, former chief of staff to Vice President Cheney. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the investigation into the CIA leak and today's arraignment in federal court in Washington of Scooter Libby, former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney. We're told by CNN that Mr. Libby has made his court appearance now. He pleaded not guilty to all five charges against him, which of course was expected. You can join the conversation in this investigation and today's arraignment. Is it justice? Do you think leaking information to reporters about a CIA officer is par for the course in politics or an outrage? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us, John Fund, columnist for The Wall Street Journal's OpinionJournal.com, John Nichols, political writer for The Nation, also Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor for The Atlantic Monthly. Back to the phones. Peter is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hello, Peter.
Yes, sir. I heard on a talk show the other day, which was something interesting about this, and that is, what is to prevent Libby and Fitzgerald from copping a plea to a lesser charge without giving anything up or giving up very little as an outcome of this, and then everything will just kind of go away? I mean, is Fitzgerald really that tough?
John Nichols, any thought to suggest that Fitzgerald will let it go away that easily?
No, none. And I am a huge defender of Patrick Fitzgerald, so you may want to bring on somebody to criticize him, but I'm not going to do it. I've followed this man since the early 1990s. He is a Republican. He is the brother of a former Republican U.S. senator. But his record as a prosecutor is that of a brilliant and aggressive Tom Dewey, Elliot Ness type character who seems to love getting to the truth and really bringing effective prosecutions. Remember, this is a guy who went after the mob in Chicago, went after corrupt public officials, really effectively took down a governor of Illinois, went after the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center in 1993. He's a remarkable man, and I think that's one thing that many people are misreading with Patrick Fitzgerald. He has a very clear pattern, very clear track record of downplaying what he's doing. He doesn't make big claims. He doesn't say, I'm going to go after this guy and get him. He's very much about the facts. And I think that what we're going to see is a good deal more happen with this investigation. I am not in the camp that believes that everything is finished. Patrick Fitzgerald has leased substantially larger offices in Washington. He has met with the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit and asked for permission to impanel another grand jury. I'm not saying that that grand jury will be impaneled, but clearly this prosecutor, I don't think he's done with his work, and I also don't think that he will pull his punches. Further, and final thing I'd add, I believe that this investigation, no matter what happens with Scooter Libby, will begin to have congressional legs. Now, certainly the Republicans in Congress will not all jump on board to dig into this, but the pressure that is being brought on them, I believe, will force the Senate Intelligence Committee to begin to look into issues related to all of this. And I do believe, as I said before, that there will be a House component as well.
John Fund, back to Mr. Libby himself. I think you're of the opinion that he believes he's not guilty and won't accept a plea bargain for that reason alone.
Well, first of all, I want to endorse having the Senate Intelligence Committee look at this. I think their last report was outstanding, and I think it cleared away a lot of the misconceptions about this whole case. But I have to tell you, I followed Mr. Nichols' work for a long time, and I've admired it. But I happen to have interviewed Mr. Fitzgerald. He says he's not a Republican. I happen to know Peter Fitzgerald, the former Republican senator from Illinois. I know they're not related. Does Mr. Nichols have information about them, you know, being related in a previous life? Because I know they're not related to each other.
John Nichols?
I apologize. That is my mistake. You're exactly right.
It's also your mistake that Mr. Fitzgerald has ever said he's a Republican. He explicitly tells reporters he is not one.
I think it is important to point out he's been appointed to positions by Republicans.
But that's not what you said, sir.
Yes, you are exactly right, John.
That's two down in one sentence.
I accept your clarification, John. But let me just say that he is someone who has been appointed by Republicans to serve in his position. And this was not to attack the guy or to criticize him. This was to say that many people are critical of Patrick Fitzgerald because he has been appointed by Republicans. I am of the camp that believes that he is a very powerful, very terrific prosecutor who will do a good job.
Let me ask a question about Vice President Dick Cheney. One of the big questions still hanging out there, John Fund, and I want you to take a crack at this. What was the purpose of Vice President Cheney's effort to seek out information about Valerie Plame and then pass on what he learned to Louis Libby?
Again, I refer you to the Senate Intelligence Committee's report, which was bipartisan and unanimous. What we had was a situation in which elements of the CIA indirectly sent Ambassador Wilson to Niger, partly at the behest of his wife, who worked with the CIA. He came back with a report, which the CIA interpreted, at least many elements of the CIA interpreted, as supporting the notion that the Iraqis had tried to purchase uranium cake from Niger. And in fact, British intelligence and French intelligence still stand by that statement. So obviously, if Wilson was going off on a mission for the CIA, coming back and using it to attack the administration politically, which is not normally what people sent on CIA missions overseas are supposed to do, why not at least go into the motivations of what the mission was all about and whether Mr. Wilson was politically motivated? I'm not saying it was wise for them to do that, especially since, you know, obviously Ms. Plame was in a sensitive position at the CIA, although not covered by the 1982 Act as a covert agent. So what you had was a political miscalculation. But for the administration to defend itself against a political attack by Mr. Wilson, who ended up joining the John Kerry campaign at that time, I think was perfectly understandable.
Mr. Cheney apparently had a private conversation with Mr. Libby on board Air Force Two. Libby then went and had a conversation with Matt Cooper of Time magazine, in which he allegedly disclosed Plame's CIA identity. The question is, did Cheney and Libby talk about Plame, and or did the vice president direct Mr. Libby to go tell Matt Cooper? This is one of the other big questions that's hanging out there, and one of the questions that strains the credibility of responses that we get. John Fund.
The administration has acted very badly in this situation because I think that they had a defensible position regarding Ms. Plame. I think they got spooked. I think they made mistakes. And I think that they should have long since apologized for political miscalculations and personal miscalculations, and they should have moved on. Now we have an investigation of Mr. Libby, who apparently has, I think, committed very serious offenses, if you believe the indictment, and I think that that will have to be answered for. However, no conspiracy, no covert agent covered by the 1982 Act, no indictment of Karl Rove, so we have to recognize this is a scandal, but this is not something that is going to cripple or debilitate this administration.
Well, except Vice President Cheney will probably end up on the witness stand in the Louis Libby trial, don't you think?
I'll make you a bet there's no trial.
You're thinking there'll be a plea bargain?
No, I think there's a problem with the use of classified information in a trial, and I also believe that Mr. Libby is clearly in enough legal jeopardy. I think that there will be a plea bargain. If it goes to trial, I can assure you that Vice President Cheney, given the sensitive nature of the classified information that is involved here, is not going to be compelled to testify.
Jack
That's
Beattie?
Not it's not going to happen.
Jack Beattie, your take on that?
I just can't imagine this prosecutor, just again, my only connection with him was just watching that press conference. But as they say, the cut of the man's jib implies he's going to go right to the limit on this. And, you know, does he have political ambitions? Well, this is one way in which you get up in the world, isn't it? This is how Tom Dewey became a presidential candidate, by being a crime buster, a crime fighter. And especially by, you know, bringing out, of course, what party is the question, if he if he gets Cheney into trouble. Look, you know, this administration is, the question is, you know, will it weaken the administration? CBS poll yesterday, I guess, Bush is now at 35% approval. That's not just a weakened president. That's a, you know,
lowest since second term of the Nixon administration.
That's right. Now, is there something that's going to make that go up in the immediate offing? I don't know what that is. It seems to me that if this Libby business is impending, things in Iraq are going to continue as they are, that's only going to go down. And each time it does, the president's power diminishes. And so the question, you know, will this hurt the Bush administration? All of this war, what General Odom calls the worst strategic mistake in U.S. history, this war has hurt this president. And now all the legal and the obfuscation around it that's now getting to be challenged legally. So it's already hurt him seriously.
Let's hear more about what On Point listeners are thinking. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Mary's on the line from Concord, Massachusetts.
Good morning, gentlemen. The people that made the case for me was not Joe Wilson, even though I think he's very articulate. It wasn't the Democrats, wasn't the Republicans. It was the former CIA agents or staff members who I've seen at hearings, congressional hearings. I've seen them on 60 Minutes, I've seen them on TV, and they have described this as a very serious breach of trust by senior levels of our administration against the CIA. Whatever the legalese is, whether there were illegalities, whether somebody broke the law or not, the point is damage has been done. Human intelligence is more important than ever, and this whole situation has definitely, from what they have said, has definitely hurt their ability to recruit human intelligence overseas, because it's a betrayal of trust, and trust is extremely important. And if anybody has a right to make a comment about the seriousness of this, these people do.
You're saying whether or not a law was broken, this is a significant problem.
The damage has been done, and former CIA employees who have put in their time and who have gone through the process are saying this is very serious. And they have also said that they have, you know, this is not the first time a CIA agent or a person has been outed. It's the first time they can remember it's been done by their own government. So this is, the damage has been done. And I can't believe that there is not an apology from this administration about this. My other comment is I think Patrick Fitzgerald should have been nominated for the Supreme Court, but maybe another time. But I don't know why anybody, you know, why we just seem to get so caught up in the legal part of this that we're totally overlooking the damage that this has done.
John Fund, there have been other suggestions that Vice President Cheney should apologize or at least explain his involvement in all of this. Do you think an apology or an explanation are coming from the vice president?
Well, from my sources, the vice president initially told Mr. Libby, and they both have classified backgrounds, about Ms. Plame, and most of this was done by Mr. Libby. So I'm not sure what the direct culpability of the vice president would be to issue an apology. And again, I would point out, Mr. Fitzgerald was asked four times in his press conference, was Valerie Plame a covert agent under the law you were investigating? And he refused to answer. And the reason for that is, yes, potentially there might have been a problem if she had been covered, but she wasn't covered. In other words, the entire underlying law here is not part of this indictment. So whether it was politically wise, whether it was prudent, is a separate matter. But was there an actual outing of a covert CIA agent at the heart of this investigation? The answer is no.
Well, but what he said was we couldn't get at that question because he said that Mr. Libby made that determination impossible by his false statement.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just add, this is a debatable point. My friend John Fund, who is making very good points here, and certainly they will be part of the argument, is taking one side in this issue. There are folks, including Joe Wilson, for instance, who says that it's quite the opposite.
Well, first of now, all, Joe Wilson's credibility has been severely tarnished.
But,
secondly, if Mr. Beatty can find me a single senior Justice Department official, either privately or publicly, who will tell him that he believes Valerie Plame was covered by the 1982 Act as a covert agent. I will submit a large check to his favorite charity. Go find that person. It doesn't exist.
But I think let's respect the caller. The caller's point, I think, is a very good one, and that is playing games in this area, playing games with outing people, whether they fit under a certain law or not, but are certainly within the CIA, and as we've learned, went to a good deal of trouble to cloak her identity. That's not what should be done. I think any American will tell you that they are troubled by that. And I think that that's what's really the problem for the administration at this point. The Scooter Libby trial is a serious problem. It's a serious issue. But it's that broader sense that this administration has gone out of its way to destroy those who might raise questions about its arguments for going to war. And that's really what Congress ought to be looking at.
Let's squeeze one more phone call into the program. Steve is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks. I'm calling to ask, it was pointed out earlier that Mr. Libby has been more loyal to his boss than to his country, and I'm calling to ask if a determined and aggressive prosecutor can make him more loyal to himself than his boss.
We'll let all three of you take this, starting with John Nichols.
I think that's a great question. Again, as I've said before, I have tremendous respect for Patrick Fitzgerald. I think he's going to do a good job. But I also think that we should not be totally obsessed with Scooter Libby. What Prosecutor Fitzgerald has done has given us an indictment which points to a lot of issues that ought to be explored. Some of them should be explored in the context of a trial and in further investigations by a grand jury. But much of it should be explored in a congressional context where Vice President Cheney and others are asked to come to Congress and explain what was going on in this office and why there seemed to be such an obsession with defending the case for going to war up to and including the point of trying to destroy the reputations of those who pointed out flaws in that case.
John Fund.
The intelligence mistakes that in part led to this war are a serious matter, and they should be given serious consideration by some objective body like the Senate Intelligence Committee. However, using the Libby case to try to refight the war in Iraq is not going to be helpful to anyone, and I will simply leave you with this question. Was what Scooter Libby said, even if it was imprudent, was what he said about Ambassador Wilson and Ambassador Wilson's wife helping to send him to Niger, was it true or not? And if it was true, I don't think you can destroy someone's reputation if you're actually telling the truth.
And Jack Beatty.
Well, first of all, John Fund has come back to this question whether she was covered by that law or not. She was, as I understand it, a member of the Directorate of Operations. There's the Directorate of Intelligence and the Directorate of Operations. Well, once you're in operations, I don't know whether that puts you under that 82 law or not, but these men, Cheney and Libby, sure knew. And that's a serious matter. And as to what's going to happen in the trial, look, I think a pardon hangs over all of this. Let's be realistic. If Mr. Libby is sentenced to jail, Bush will pardon him when he leaves. I'm almost sure.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, John Fund, columnist for The Wall Street Journal's OpinionJournal.com, and John Nichols, political writer for The Nation. Thanks very much to all of you for joining us today on On Point, and thanks for your phone calls. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Bob Oakes, in today for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.